All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. God is change.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to Octavia's Parables. We are reading Parable of the Talents, the second book in the Parables trilogy. And the last book published of the Parables trilogy, Parable of the Talents. We read Parable of the Sower last season, and you can go back and listen to that entire season if you haven't yet. It'll definitely help you understand this one. I am Adrienne Marie Brown. I'm your co-host, and I'm here with
Toshi Regan.
Yes, the one, the only, the God. So any announcements for our second episode? Any announcements? Anything we need to know?
Well, I'm hoping my record will be out in March. My intent, yeah. Ooh. So, yeah, just watch the IG page, and I'll be doing some things.
Okay, beautiful. We promise to watch. And if you missed it, last episode we announced a couple of things. The New Suns Literary Festival and the Confluence Octavia Butler Festival. Yeah. Is that what it was called?
It's the Octavia E. Butler Conference.
Okay, yeah. The Octavia E. Butler Conference. Yeah. Toshi did a full set there, which you can find and listen to. And I have a keynote that's out in the world with Amma Josephine Budge. So, yay. Lots and lots of Octavia content in every direction.
Yeah.
So let's drop ourselves into chapter 2, episode 2. Can you start us off?
Yes. Chapter 2, from Earthseed, the books of the living. Chaos is God's most dangerous face, amorphous, roiling, hungry shape. Shape chaos, shape God, act. Alter the speed or the direction of change. Vary the scope of change. Recombine the seeds of change. Transmute the impact of change. Seize change. Use it. Adapt and grow.
Yes.
Yeah. I messed up a little bit because we actually have this in music in the show, and I started, chaos is God's most dangerous face, which is what we sing in the show. So here we go.
Can we hear that?
Yeah, we'll have to share a little bit.
Okay.
So yeah, we're back with Bencole and Lauren's daughter, and she is on her journey of researching her parents' life and especially her mother's life. And so she is recounting the original 13 settlers of Acorn. And if you read Parable of the Sower, you're familiar with all of them. Mm-hmm. And she names everyone, the children, all of the people who were there. And she also is starting to give us a little window into life on Acorn. And she says that every member of Earthseed learned to read and to write. And if you remember from Parable, a lot of the people in that original group didn't know how to read or write. And they were learning. And then she also turned kind of everybody into teachers. Anybody who knew how to do something, knew a trade that they had to teach people. And that basically children are so assaulted at this time. Children are, the idea of children going to school is not, children are, you know, taken, they're neglected, they're turned into slaves and workers, they're sold, everything bad. And so she really is determined that people would be educated and learn a skill, learn how to do something. And Lauren's daughter lets us know that her father had the most valuable skill of anyone, which is that he was a doctor. And that those were rare, especially where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And so that actually, him being a doctor, at first, a lot of people in the area where they are were not trusting of a black man, because there's not a lot of black folks up there, and racism, my goodness, just hanging in there for every situation. but eventually he could not be denied, that people really had to accept when they needed help, and when things were bad. So she gives us that information, and then she turns to the journals of Lauren Oya Alamina, and it is Monday, September 27th. The year is 2032. And Lauren is feeling tight. You know, she's I don't know how to talk about this day. I don't know how to talk about today. And I remember that from some thing in Parable where she doesn't know what to do. And she says, I have to write. And what she's really, you know, feeling a lot about is basically that Jarrett is starting to seem appealing to some of the people at Acorn. That, you know, Jarrett coming with his Make America Great Again and his really heavy, as she calls, religious nonsense. And some of the people are thinking he might not be so bad. And you know what this reminded me of was and Corey in Parable when Olivar started, and mm-hmm. Corey exactly. was like, we should go to Olivar, like, which one's worse? Like, so these, you know, everybody's in a state of exhaustion, so you know that these people are just like, how do we get someplace where we can settle down and have something that we consider normal, and because they haven't seen it in a long time, so they're kind of willing to look at this person, and they're looking for order and stability. And Lauren really understands it because everybody has lost a lot, but she doesn't think that's the way to go. So this conversation is happening at their anniversary gathering, and it just kind of gives a tone of like something is about to happen. Something is shaking. And she's very disturbed by it. So one of the things that they are, this group, is scavengers. And so they have built Acorn up by, you know, buying some things, by finding some things on the land, by trading and bartering. But they also scavenge. They just go to places, abandoned properties, and they find seeds. They find, you know, whatever has been discarded that they can make use of. And so a group goes together, and there's two sharers in this group and two non-sharers, which Lauren tells us is very important to have a balance. And they are, you know, they're picking all kinds of things. They're getting plants, and they're looking for agave, which is a specific leaf that has jagged edges and thorns. And they're looking for it because on their wall, they want to place it inside of their wall, which they say is okay, but that people could get through it if they wanted to. And so they want to make it even harder for people to get through. And they're just on this like abandoned land that there's a, you know, things have been burned down. And while they're there, they see like a car and what they call a house car or house truck.
They call it a house truck.
Yeah. They see a house truck.
Yeah.
Do you have a vision for what that looks like in your mind?
I do.
What's your vision of the house truck?
I'm glad you know that. To me, the house truck is like one of these really massive, you know, it's those big trucks with the like, you know, it's got a passenger row in the front bed, and it's got a big open bed, but it's been covered over and fortified so that people can, you know, the whole thing I imagine being sort of covered over and fortified so that people can drive it and maybe be shot at or other things and be okay, and that you cannot see inside the back of it and possibly can't really see inside the front of it.
I love that.
That's what I imagine.
I love it. I'm going with it. So it's Lauren, Michael, and Jorge Cho, who's also a sharer, and Natividad. Yep. And they're, you know, picking they're picking up the little things and putting them in their basket or their hand truck and moving along, and then they see the truck, and then everything just gets crazy. They hear gunshot, they have to hide. When the gunshot is done, Jorge takes a peek, and then he sees that someone's shot, so he's done. He's on the ground.
Yep.
He's rolling around. He's in terrible pain. And Lauren is helping him, and she's much better at, knowing when to look, knowing when not to look. And also, yeah. She's really, really good with, like, even though he's in pain, she can feel it mildly, but she has done the work where she's like, I'm not taking all of that in. So she is good and yelling at him, like, what'd you look for? But they know not to move from where they are because they can't get any place. And they hear a child crying, but they don't go towards it. And the conversation between the four of them about, like, what to do is amazing. It's yes. like, yeah. it's you know, I just wrote strategy, you know, because they talk amongst themselves, like, you know, as a child, but, you know, people use children now, like, so you can't just go. And just trying to figure it out. So they stay there until it gets dark. And then I love this part. I just love all the specificness of how to be safe and how to save yourself in very unsafe situations. And there's this chimney, and they want to get behind it so that they can kind of, like, make their way out of this situation. So they succeed in that, and they kind of are ready to go. And then they hear a young child crying again. And Lauren's like, I want to go see about the child. And they're like, yep. Nah. Lauren's like, I want to see about the child. And I want to say Lauren is 23 years old at this time. So Lauren at 23 wants to go see about the child. And she finds the child, and it's a 6 or 7 year old girl. She's completely filthy. And she says, beyond filthy. And they see that the truck door is open, and they look in, and there's two people have been shot, and there's another child who's asleep, and there's, like, I think some dead people nearby or something.
Yeah, I think there's two dead people in the field nearby.
Yep, and so they're like, we're taking these children and we're taking this truck. And one of them knows how to drive. And it's a huge thing to them. Like, it's a huge thing that they get to have this truck. That whole thing I just said, and just like these a little bit of... a few words is almost the entire chapter. It's huge. And she goes into great detail about the plants and the specific plants that they're picking. She goes into great detail about everything. Like, that, you know, there's more talking about sharing pain, and it's great conversation between them around what, you know, is a shared practice that they have. Like, they work together so much. They are inside of a kind of rhythm that is life-saving. It's not that, you know, they have all these weapons and everything. They do have some, but it's the way that they are with each other. It's the way they all knew to go someplace together. It's the way they knew to hunker down.
Exactly.
It's the way they had the patience to wait until it got dark so they would have more opportunity. It's just, they have developed these practices over time with each other, repetition, taking it seriously, and they care for children. At least Lauren does. So this truck is a big deal, and if you think about the journey from Robledo, they have never had a vehicle. Like, they have been walking.
Exactly.
They have been walking miles. They have never been able to zoom up or down or back or anything of the highway. So this is such a great thing. And Bangkok.
Yeah, and to look at something that's being used, weaponized, right? Because it's like they're trying to run over people. And they're like, okay, we'll wait it out, but we could use that.
Yeah.
We can immediately see that resource could be used for something else.
Yeah, and the truck is like, mm-hmm. you know, it's a truck of the time. So it's got, like, radar devices, and it's hooked up. They are like, you know, we don't know who these awful people were, but we going to get these children, and we're going to try to save these other people, and then we're going to take their truck. So it's very cool. Back at home, you know, Lauren and Bankole are basically, you know, cuddling, and Bankole is like, what's, you know, kind of just trying to figure his wife out. Like, he's just like, you know, you have seen children in chains being led, you know, Like, you've seen the worst that can happen to children. Like, why were you so moved to go and help these children, you know? Like, he's still, bless his heart, he still doesn't get it sometimes. So she is like, no, I mean, I like children. Like, there's a baby crying. I'm going to try to do something.
I'm going to get them. Which is so funny because, like, he's the one in Parable of the Sower who saves one of the children.
Yep.
That's one of the ways they bond, you know? I'm like,
yet
he still seems surprised.
I mean, they've all seen a lot. And the last little bit of this chapter, which is pretty amazing, and I'm really feeling it, is Bancole being like, it's time for us to look at leaving. And
yes.
that is such a big thing. You know, Lauren is just getting started, but he's like, I went and looked at these towns nearby, and we could actually, like, have a house and be in a town, and a doctor would come in handy. And, like, our life could be different. And Lauren is like, no, you're not going anywhere. You mine, and you staying here. She is like, no.
This is our place.
She says, I don't care. You belong here. Don't even think about going away. But he reminds her that he's getting older and that, you know, he might actually need to shift from this acorn life, which is 24/7 work. And that's chapter two.
And that he might die
eventually
too. You know, I think that there's that longer term thinking, and there's a couple of lines in their dialogue with each other that stand out to me. Mm. One is like when he's initially, because he's not pleased with her for getting the truck. You know, he's like, that was brazen. That was like not the safest thing that you did there.
Mm-hmm.
And Lauren says, if I didn't love him, I might not like him much at times. Like,
yes.
Which I think is like just essential relationship, you know, how to, right? It's just like there's these moments where you're like, I love you, and that's what's going to get us through this moment right now, because we really disagree. And then there's a moment later where, you know, all the communities that he could go and be the doctor for are very white. And she says, about the acorn community, we're, you name it, Black, white, Latino, Asian, and any mixture at all.
Yeah.
The kind of thing you'd expect to find in a city. The kids we've adopted and the ones who have been born to us think of all the mixing and matching as normal.
Yeah.
Imagine that. And that piece feels so important to me for understanding what is the vision of acorn and what is the vision of the society that they're trying to create. It's like, what is literally the counter vision of the Christian America vision, the way that white supremacy and racism and religion have braided themselves together into this, you know, this force that is really like choking the life out.
That's right.
Out of the nation. Yeah. So I just wanted to uplift those pieces because when I read them, I was like, oh, that's fascinating. And I think really relevant for a lot of people right now.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, because that is the victorious feeling that I feel inside my spirit is that's it. And, you know, and it's actively, you know, it's actively meeting the times and the time. And some people don't like it and are, you know, and are trying their best to move against it, you know? And
yes,
but I feel our movement is so relentless, you know, in terms of like, where we're going. And especially, I think, when it comes to, like, our trans siblings who are out here in the world and, and, you know, declaring, like, this is our place, you know?
This is our place. And also, in some ways, it's like, you will not have a species and you will not have a safety that does not include
us. That's right.
You won't. You never have.
Yeah.
And you will not.
You will not. You know. It's time for all of us to get with that, because that is just the truth.
Yeah. So I have mad questions for this chapter. So this chapter, I feel like it drops us really back into the way Lauren Olamina builds community. And we start to really get into, like, what are some of the pragmatic thoughts, pragmatic questions, practical things that we need to be attending to when we're thinking about how we build a community, how we choose a space, who we trust, those things.
Mm-hmm.
So my questions are really picking up on some of the additional, the deeper lessons that she's giving us
right
here. The first is, how many languages do you know? And by yourself, how many languages do you know? And how many languages are you in community with people knowing, right? So I love the requirement that everyone has to have at least two languages, primarily English and Spanish, in the community. And I speak English, and I've been taking my little Duolingo now. You know, I'm like, I've got 412 days of practice or whatever it is. So, you know, which doesn't mean I'm fluent in Spanish, but it does mean that I understand it much more than I did 412 days ago. But I think about this often. It's like, I remember being on a boat once from Spain to Morocco. I was on this boat that looked like a cruise ship, but it was not. It was not inside. Everyone on the boat, I was in like a room with four other women, and none of them spoke. I think one of them spoke some English, and then there was like someone who spoke French and Spanish, and someone who spoke Spanish and something else, and then there were just languages I didn't know. And we were heading into Morocco, we were heading into Africa, and there were just like the languages between us. I think there were four or five things being spoken. We talked all night.
Mm.
We talked all night. Mm. But it was like this game of translating between
mm-hmm.
all these different languages that we spoke. And it was beautiful, but it also made me hunger for understanding more languages and being able to be more of that kind of citizen. And I'm reminded of that when I read this. Every time I'm like, oh,
yeah,
oh, like I need to really learn this. So I want people to ask themselves that, and just in your pod, in your community, in your group, right? What is the spread of languages that you actually know fluently?
Mm-hmm.
Second question, have you mastered a trade that would be of use to a community post-internet?
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, are there any doctors or nurses or people who can really do emergency care in your close circle and in your neighbor circle? This question, the first time I read the Parable of the Talents, changed my trajectory of my life in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I'm a philosopher at heart. Like, that's my job. It's like, I just want to think thoughts. And this book made me like, yeah, bitch, but you also need to know how to do something, like, real with bodies, just in case. Because you want to be able to make a case for yourself if the community is like, well, we got to go and... we don't need Foucault. We got to go. We need, like, what can you do? And I really was like, I need to know something. So now I know how to doula. I know how to cook. And I'm learning how to grow things, you know.
There
but
you
I'm
go.
Like, I really want to be of use in some way.
So, I love you so much.
thank you. You know, and I think music counts as one of those necessary things. So I think you're good. But I was like, I need to be good.
Mm.
So
that's amazing.
Yeah. My third question, which I'd love to think about a little bit with you. Do you understand the motivations of people who turn to nation state, who want to return to something, even if it's unjust, in the name of order
mm-hmm.
and stability?
Yeah. I mean, I think people navigate that a lot. And, this was will be really an interesting time, but I think people want to have whatever they think is predictable and normal, is comforting, you know.
Yes.
And even as that gets smaller and smaller, they'll like, almost it's like an island, and you know, maybe, you know, first on your island you had your own, you know, there was your own house and it had running water and it had electricity and you had a job, and maybe if you had a partner they had a job. And you both could do this. And then like one of you loses a job, but you still have the house. And then you go to the, and then, all right, well, maybe we can't be in this house. We have to go move in with, you know, some parents. And then, you know, the thing gets smaller and smaller. And, but people try to uphold it. And you see that now. I feel, you know, what happened across the South with the winter storm is a big, like, kick in of the delusion of that. It's like, here, Texas, not all the states, but Texas in particular, is like, we're Texas and we don't need nobody and we don't want nobody. And they Republican politicians are particularly vicious when it comes to other states that actually have emergencies and need support. And not only that, but they're like, we don't want to be a part of this other electrical grid. We just going to have our own. And, you know, you wonder, like, how people have said, well, we're going to have that. Like, that's yes. cool that we, yes, yeah. our own. And then they have the predatory electricity, which is, like, gauged on the market. Like, I don't even know what that means, you know, and it's not that yeah. all the electricity is cool, because these grids are very vulnerable all over the country, and our use of electricity yeah. is, you know, we all need to reckon with that. But the idea that what you decided to believe in was going to support and uphold you, and then when you find out here's a climate crisis emergency, that yes. because these same people have been in denial of the climate crisis, and that they are completely greedy, like just yes. about themselves. They never protected the electrical grid against these storms. They never winterized it, which they could have done. They could have spent the money.
They could have done it. That's right.
And so I guess in addition to that is, why don't you ask for what you deserve? Because
that's right.
And do you know what you deserve? Or are you That's just right. like living and until the catastrophe happens? And I just That's think right. people can make a lot of assumptions about where they are and follow behind. The same people that you're following behind are giving you this bad electricity, and then they're giving a predatory electricity, and then they're not winterizing the grid, and then they're also not supporting anybody else who's like they're mean and they're awful people. And you're like,
yes,
but I somehow feel secure with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what is, you know, possibly the most brilliant strategy in the American experiment is the American dream.
Mm-hmm.
And really making people think like, this dream is common, it's shared, we could all have access to it. It's about being normal, yeah. being stable. And so that even though the majority of people in the country don't actually have access to
That's
it,
right.
The idea of the dream is so compelling, and people are constantly trying to perform their own normalcy, their own stability, particularly for their kids, particularly in competition with each other, in relationship to each other. And, you know, I really think that if the dream was not there, like if that concept of America wasn't so prevalent, I think that we would have had a different level of uprising and revolution a long time ago, because people would have been like, the way we're actually being treated, like these conditions are not livable.
Right.
This is not working for us. And so I think there would have been much more of an uprising. But because of the combination of the dream and credit,
yeah.
you know, and like yeah. ways that you can kind of stretch and pretend like the blanket covers your whole body
yeah.
When you're freezing and you're wet and you're miserable
yeah.
and your children are not safe is deep. So I really think, you know, even now, like we just went through these 4 years of the 45 administration, and folks are like, okay, now that's behind
yes.
us. And so as we're watching Biden come in, and, you know, the immediate first moves are like not really upholding the promises
that's right.
that he ran on. But there's so many people are like, oh, can we just have the normalcy though? Can we just have some stability? Like, I don't even want to talk about those things. And just noticing like that the sugary, sticky, sweet molasses functionality of the American dream, that it's like we get stuck in it like flies
yeah.
and then we're like, we're dying, but we don't realize it because everything tastes still good still.
Yeah. You know? Lauren so, says in that yeah. chapter that peace is dangerous.
Yes.
She says it's dangerous because it just makes people complacent, and she says that, you know, when the thing happened to the Dovetree family when they got attacked, you know, everybody should have been like, okay, there's something
exactly.
happening, especially because it wasn't like a regular attack that they've encountered. And I also think, you know, I talked about last time, like, how is the media supporting these narratives? But it's almost like these stories get carried. The thing in Texas is going to get carried, like, you know, this weird thing happened and all of these people suffered exactly. because of it, and not actually like really illuminate that it's a systemic taking advantage and endangering all the people of that right. state. And, you know, and I think that that happens a lot. If we challenge these, you know, institutions to meet us where we need to be met, you know, we're in for a long time of being like the people in Acorn. Like, you're not settling down to rest and be quiet.
Yes.
You're settling down to be in right relationship with each other and the land that you're on. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And I really deeply believe, I mean, this is one of the main reasons I think I identify as an abolitionist, because, you know, I do think at a certain point you have to say, well, we have given you a very long time to experiment with this. And I keep uplifting, you know, Miriam Kaba and Rachel Herzig talk about this, but, you know, that we've been in this long experiment of 250 years of well-funded carceral systems.
Yes.
And we've been in this American experiment of, you know, faux democracy with the Electoral College and all of it. We've done it.
Yeah.
It has not worked. And so at what point do you divest from that system? And even if it means there's going to be disorder, chaos, and instability. And I think that this book is really like, and how long?
Yeah.
For how long will that last?
Yeah.
And we haven't even gotten into it yet. So thank you for engaging with me on that. I have a few more questions. So, you know, the book immediately is letting us know how perilous the space and the time actually are. And Lauren is really still the strategic gatherer of her people and their resources. And so I want to ask our readers, our listeners, to sit with, what do you make of Lauren's choices in this chapter? The choice to wait, the choice to get the truck, the choice to resist relocation with Bancole. Like, each of the choices she's making, do you understand strategically what's driving her here? And where do you see yourself in relationship to her? Are you the Lauren in your community? Are you the Bancole? Are you someone else, another sharer, right? A young sharer who doesn't yet know how to manage your powers?
Yes.
Other things. Like, where are you? Lauren has learned to work with her sharing some. I really love that you pointed that out, that she's like, she knows where to look now. She knows how much attention to bring to it to keep herself safe.
Mm-hmm.
And the question it yielded for me was, how can you hone an apparent weakness into a strength through the work of mastery?
Ooh.
Right? Because empathy is something we want to have.
Yes.
Right? And so even though at first it's overwhelming, now she's learning to work with it.
Yes.
And to even teach others how to work with it. So
that's an empowering
question. I
want to ask
y'all that question.
Mm-hmm. I love that question. Mm-hmm. I got stronger just thinking about it.
Yay.
Yeah, thank you.
Good. I like that. Couple more. Who do you trust to move through danger with? And I want to be clear here. I don't just mean who do you trust to follow you? Who do you trust to like do what you want them to do during dangerous moments? But who do you actually trust? Like, you might have to listen to what their assessment is and do what they say. Yeah. And then these final questions are about Lauren and Bancole's relationship and the conversations they're having towards the end of this chapter. Have you had to assess diversity as a key factor in determining where you would live? And would you choose whiteness with safety or diversity with risk? Right? Like, I know a lot of people who have had this very specific conversation. It feels so relevant. I love that Octavia knew it was relevant in the 90s, and I think it's going to be relevant for quite some time. That because it's not like you actually are safe, you know. It's like Bancole is still fighting against people's perception of him as a black man when he goes into these white spaces,
right.
But he perceives that it would still be safer for her, safer for them.
And as my mother did both, you know, because we lived in a black community, but I was tearing it up at the public schools. I was fighting all the time. And she was like, nope. She's like, no, nope. Burgundy Farm Country Day School. Sandy Springs Friends School. You know, she was just like, no, this is not going to work. And she saved my life. She saved my life.
Go, Mom.
Yes, thank you, Mom.
Go, Mom. Last question. How do you communicate at the intersection of love and fear? How do you communicate at the intersection of love and fear? Bankole is almost always asking Lauren questions from his love of her, right? He's like, I love you so deeply. I'm so dedicated to your longevity, your brilliance, your safety. And Lauren is like, yeah, that's cool. I'm trying to build this whole ass community and I have a destiny and stuff. And I also love you. And I think there's so many relationships and I know that are like that, right? Where it's just like, I love you. But loving you is not my purpose. My purpose is this other thing.
Yeah.
And I want you to join me in the purpose. And then, you know, but then for some people, like the person they love is their purpose.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do think what Bankole is doing, loving Lauren, is a purposeful love.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel that juxtaposition?
Yeah.
As a lover, as a parent, as a person?
Yeah. Yeah. And I really think about it, you know, again with my mom, because my mom had her mission and we, you know, we were her kids and she traveled all the time and,
yeah.
You know, because that was her mission and she had all her work and she also was a great mom. But I remember one time I was having like, you know, one of the hardest surgeries I ever had and I was in a hospital for a long time and there was a little bit of incompetence happening and my mother had to go to Japan. And so she basically, like, one day she just was like, it was day 28, and she walked into the hospital and she said, I'm taking my daughter home. And they were like, well, we think, she's like, no, I have to go to Japan and in a few days and I can't leave her here. I have to make sure she's somewhere where people I know will be taking care of her, and she's leaving today. And you know, I was like, you know, up in traction.
How do you feel about that, Tashi?
I was so happy to go home. I love my mama.
you're like, yes, no, it was, get me out of
it
here.
Was hard. It was a hard thing. I had to fight for my life in there. But the day she walked in there, the shock on the people's faces, that she was just like, it's time to go. Like, I don't know what y'all came here to do, but I came here to take my daughter home and finish healing her. So you all have had this amount of days. I kind of think you don't know what else to do. And she took me out. And then she got on a plane. Like, she left me with cool people, y'all. Just don't be mad at Bernice.
I mean, I know that for sure.
But she got on a plane 3 days later, and Sweet Honey went to Japan. And then that was a wrap, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, I do. I really do. I've learned a lot of lessons about that too, that sometimes you're in relationship with someone and they're trying to actually keep you from your mission. And it's disguised as love.
Yes.
And they're trying to keep you from what you are here to do. And they worry you and try to distract you and try to keep you from your mission. And then you can feel like it will be the worst thing in the world if you actually do your mission. And it's like, you know what I'm talking about?
I have been in that place, honey. I have been in that place both with people who are trying to keep me from my mission. And also, I have been in the place where I became convinced that the person I was loving, like that I was supposed to love them to complete their mission, right? I was like, oh, my work is to make sure you achieve your mission.
Yeah.
And like lost track of like, wait, I got my own mission.
You know,
I'm supposed to be doing like, it's foggy over here. But I do feel like it is such a powerful thing when you're able to recognize, like, you know, I feel the love in the two of them.
Yeah.
Where, and I feel that in my life now, where I'm like, I have a mission. I'm with someone else who has a mission. And our love is like, you know, the bridge house, right? It's like we are joined, but we are also both developing and rooting and growing things that are bigger than ourselves and bigger than even our lifetimes.
Yes.
And I actually feel like my community is a bunch of people on missions.
Yes.
And so we're constantly supporting each other as we see. You know, to me, I'm like, I want to be in a million love ships where we're all supporting each other. Like, yes, yes, yes. Look at all this destiny unfolding.
Yes.
And I think that to me, that's the kind of acorn beyond one place or beyond one location.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's the kind of acorn. It's like there's a bunch of people who are seeding destiny in their own lives. And because of what we fear,
right.
You know, like to me, my destiny is also in response. Like it would be a lie for me to say it wasn't fed in any part by fear.
Right.
Right. Like I want our species to be here, and there's a bunch of babies that I love who I want to be here.
Yes.
And part of my destiny is to make that more possible.
Yeah.
Right now, you know, in this period of apocalypse and in what we're reading, it just makes me think about what it means to love people. Like Thich Nhat Hanh says, how do you love someone so that they feel free?
Mm-hmm.
And like, what does it mean to love people towards freedom in apocalyptic periods of history?
Yeah.
Where you know, you're like, I can't protect this thing that I love more than anything. I can't protect this person from being brave and being themselves and like growing in ways that serve the greater purpose. So
all of that.
Chapter 2,
y'all.
Right? Octavia's Parables is hosted by Toshi Regan and myself, Adria Marie Brown. We are produced by Kat Aaron. Our show art is by the incredible Krista Franklin.
Our music, Always See the Stars, written and performed by Toshi Regan, and God Is Change, written by Toshi Regan, performed by Toshi Regan and Bernice Johnson Regan.
Find us on Twitter at @OParables. You can sustain our show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/OParables. And we will see you next time.
All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change. All that you touch, you change. All that you change, changes you. The only lasting truth is change.